Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. It's a pleasure to welcome you all here to Bligh Street for today's events. Let me recognise my chairman, Frank Lowy, and one of my board members, Stephen Lowy, and of course the treasurer, Scott Morrison. We're very pleased indeed to welcome him back. Before I introduce the treasurer, let me just give a little ad if I can. The treasurer's speech comes at a transitional moment for the Institute's work on international economic policy, because today, after 4 years, the work of our G20 Studies Centre comes to an end. This is work that has been supported by the Australian Treasury over the past 4 years to analyse the G20, an enormously important organisation that accounts for two-thirds of the world's population, five-sixths of the world's output and three-quarters of the world trade. And crucially, of course, it's an organisation that Australia is a member of. And this is the kind of work that we're very proud of and we believe the Institute was made for. We won't be vacating the field of international economic governance, of course. There are not many sources of international macroeconomic analysis outside Canberra, and we plan to stay in this game. Ladies and gentlemen, sometimes people think that international policy is all about diplomacy, and they think that institutes like the Lowy Institute are therefore all about diplomacy. But of course, the biggest single contributor to a nation's power, influence, and indeed its clout in the world is the economy. Australia is blessed with natural resources, but plenty of resource-rich countries are poor. We have succeeded as a country because of our ingenuity. Our prosperity is tied up with our trade with Asia, much of it in services. Our future will be determined more by how we use our heads and our hands than by what is in the ground beneath our feet. And it will also be determined by another important part of the economic story for our country, and that's migration. Properly managed, skilled migration grows our economy and our wealth. It improves our demographics, making us a vigorous country rather than a feeble one. It thickens our connections to the economies around us. The qualities of the immigrant are highly correlated with the qualities of the entrepreneur. And these are the themes that Mr. Morrison will speak to us today about. Ladies and gentlemen, Scott Morrison has been the member for Cook since 2007. He served in a number of portfolios and he was sworn in as the 39th Treasurer of Australia on the 21st of September 2015. By my count, this is the fourth time that Scott has spoken to the Institute. In 2010 and 2012, he spoke to us as Shadow Minister for Productivity and Population and Shadow Minister for Immigration and Citizenship. In 2014, he spoke as the Minister for Immigration and Border Protection, and now he visits us as Treasurer. Treasurer, if you keep up this biannual pattern, we may as well book in your speech for 2018 now. He's also joining us just before his beloved Cronulla Sharks make their fourth grand final appearance, so thank you for making time. If he looks a bit nervous, that's probably why. Of course, the Sharks have been in four grand finals, but I don't think they've won one yet. And I believe it was the legendary coach Jack Gibson who once said, waiting for Cronulla to win a premiership is like leaving the porch light on for Harold Holt. But I know you're a true believer in the Sharkies, Scott, so I wish you good luck for Sunday. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Treasurer Scott Morrison to the stage.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. It's great to be here again. And to Frank and to Stephen, thank you very much for being here today for this address today. It is true, I'm a very happy shark today. The most exciting time to be a fan of the Cronulla Sharks. So much so that this morning I ate a blue sausage down in the shark territory. I just took the one bite, to be honest, because I was hoping it was blue for reasons of food dye and not anything else. But everyone down in the Shire is very excited about the weekend, and all those porch lights will be on tonight and on Saturday night, and we can switch them off after Sunday. But today I'm completing the third in a series of presentations that I've been giving, which is addressing this topic of staying the course. And after 25 years of uninterrupted annual economic growth, an entire generation has grown up without ever having known a recession in this country. This is despite a global financial crisis, an Asian financial crisis, global terrorism, SARS, 1 in 100 year floods, droughts, and a 1/3 fall in our terms of trade. For some, a quarter of a century of economic growth has given rise to complacency. What does it matter if our budget is in deficit, they ask, or our debt is now growing at $1.4 billion in gross terms a week? Just raise taxes and borrow more. What could possibly go wrong? The last election, Labor actually proposed to increase the deficit by $16.5 billion, increase taxes, and are on record arguing there is ample room to further increase our government debt even further. But for others, they are asking different questions about why they feel they have not benefited from Australians' growth as much as they may have expected. They are asking practical questions as families, like why are our wages not increasing like they used to? Or why can't I get the extra hours that I was getting before? Or where will the next job come from? Or indeed the jobs of their kids? Now these sentiments and these questions are very real, and they are looking for something to explain it as to how they feel. According to a recent poll, almost half of all Australians are in favour of banning Muslim immigration. There are similar results for banning foreign investment and opposing free trade agreements. Support for these measures is the product of genuine anxiety in our community about these issues, and it can be politically popular and indeed rewarding to simply endorse these policy sentiments, as some do. However, there is great danger in following this path. Investment, trade and immigration bans not only fail to address the real cause of the concerns that Australians and anxieties that they feel have, but worse, they would cut Australians off from the primary sources of our prosperity for over two centuries. Australia cannot afford to adopt what I call the doona economics approach, which says that you can pull the doona over your head and somehow we can insulate ourselves from the economic changes that are occurring globally and domestically. Foreign investment, trade and immigration, and I mean an immigration program that is focused on bringing people to Australia who make a contribution rather than take one, creates jobs, boosts wages, drives growth, increases our living standards, and always has. Ensuring that foreign investment, trade and immigration policies continue to serve our national interest is a key and core component of the Turnbull government's National Economic Plan for Jobs and Growth. During the past month, I have been delivering a series of presentations titled Staying the Course, setting out how the Turnbull government's National Plan for Jobs and Growth is being implemented to address the concerns of Australians seeking greater job and income security in a transitioning economy to deal with the cost of living pressures that they face. In the first of these presentations, I stressed the need for us to build up our economic resilience to deal with the inevitable external shocks that will come our way. In addition to making our banking and financial system even stronger, we must urgently address our climbing public debt. Thanks to the Howard Costello government, when the last crisis hit, the Commonwealth was debt-free in net terms. They achieved this by doing three things. Firstly, they arrested the growth in debt that stood at 18.1% of GDP when they were elected by restoring the budget from a deficit of 2.1% of GDP in 95-6 to zero in 97-98. This was achieved predominantly by getting public expenditure under control. Secondly, they maintained budget surpluses for a decade by implementing economic reforms that supported growth in our economy. As national incomes rose from increased profits, higher wages and prices for what we were selling, so did government revenues. By not spending more than was coming in for 10 years, they achieved accumulated surpluses of 11.5% of GDP that eroded the debt year on year. And thirdly, the Howard Costello government realised asset sales of almost 9% of GDP from 96-97 onwards. This further assisted the retirement of debt and provided the foundation of the Future Fund that now stands at more than $120 billion. Now, to arrest our debt, we must first get the budget back into balance by first getting expenditure under control. The budget I delivered in May projects a return to balance in 2021, subject to parameter variations, of course, with Commonwealth expenditure to fall from 25.8% down to 25.2%, which is still above trend. To get this expenditure under control requires us to address the cumulative impact of previous spending decisions and make them affordable in today's fiscal environment. Prior to the 2013-14 budget, as you can see from this chart, there had been 14 consecutive budgets where the government made decisions to increase policy spending in net terms, and that is shown by the red bars you can see there below the line. What this means is that policy decisions to increase spending on new programs and initiatives were not offset in those budgets or paid for by policy decisions to reduce spending in other areas. Now, in surplus years, as you can see by those grey and green bars, the new policy spending was paid for by higher revenues, reflected there in the parameter changes, driven by increased employment and the growing incomes of a growing economy. Nominal GDP growth from 03-04 to 06-07 was around 8% per year. There was also less pressure on welfare spending as a growing proportion of the working age population was going into work in jobs. In the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd years, new policy spending, as you can see there in 08-09 in particular, reached historic levels at 26% of GDP. Now, this included converting temporary spending measures from the Howard government in the form of various supplement payments introduced under that government when they could be afforded, and these were translated into permanent payments under Labor. Now, there are now 53 supplement payments in our welfare system today. During this time, nominal growth in GDP fell from 5.8%, and the record new spending was funded by significantly increasing the debt. The result under Labor was a huge surge in net debt, from a positive balance, money in the bank, of some $45 billion in the budget they inherited, to a net debt of over $200 billion in the budget they left behind. Net debt is now back at more than 17% of GDP. Now, the other outcome from this period was to hard bake in more than a decade of structural increases in policy spending into the budget, which now comprise an inestimable proportion of our current spending profile. With an inherited deficit, a growing debt, and nominal growth over the last 3 years running at less than 3%, we have been disciplined as a government not to spend more than we save. But there is much more to do. Our task is to address expenditure measures wherever possible that can no longer be afforded, are no longer fit for purpose, or can be better targeted to achieve the service levels that we all expect. The same applies to revenue measures where it leads to greater sustainability and an integrity of the tax base. And our changes to retirement incomes on both the assets test for the age pension and the superannuation tax concession changes are primary examples of this approach. In our last sitting week in Parliament, we finally made some progress in getting $6.3 billion in expenditure reductions passed through the Parliament, which will reduce Commonwealth debt by more than $30 billion by 26-27. Now, it took 3 years to get there, and it represents, frankly, only a modest start. There is another $20 billion that the government has in expenditure restraint measures yet to be passed by the Parliament. But as was the case with the Howard Costello government, the debt will not be repaid by expenditure measures alone. To pay back the debt, we will need to boost our incomes by implementing economic policies that will lift productivity, drive investment, increase profits, and support higher real wages. That is why, in my second address at the Australia-Israel Chamber in Melbourne recently, I titled it Staying the Course, Increasing What We Earn. I set out a series of initiatives the Turnbull government was implementing to increase the earnings of businesses, wage earners, as a result, governments. Our enterprise tax plan, our national competition policy reforms, our national innovation and science agenda, our 20-year defence procurement plan, and our $50 billion national infrastructure plan, just to name a few. Today, though, I want to address how keeping the door open of our economy to investment, trade and immigration will also help increase what we earn and boost our living standards. As a large resource-rich country with relatively high demand for capital, Australia has relied on foreign investment to meet the shortfall of domestic savings against domestic investment needs for over two centuries. That chart goes back to 1860. Unlike many advanced economies, Australia needs to fund a current account deficit of around 4% of GDP on average each year. Restricting the foreign capital inflows needed to fund this size would result in a reduction in living standards for Australians, with less investment, lower growth, fewer jobs and lower wages. Previous Treasury modelling suggested that this reduced capital inflow would lower GDP over a following decade by 2.6%, gross national income by 2%, and would reduce real wages by 7.2%. Foreign capital has allowed the Australian people, including our generation, more than probably any other, to enjoy higher rates of economic growth, employment, and a higher standard of living than could have otherwise been achieved from domestic savings alone. The Australian economy has been built on successive waves of foreign investment, first from Britain, then the United States, Japan, and now increasingly from China. In 2014-15, the government approved almost $200 billion in foreign investment flows into Australia to fill the gap in investment demand. Over the past 5 years, investment from China has grown most strongly by more than 20% off a low base, while there has been a 10% plus growth from Canada, Japan and the Netherlands. Notwithstanding this growth in Chinese investment, in 2014-15, Chinese applications accounted for less than a quarter of all applications by value. Today, there is more than $3,000 billion of foreign investment in Australia. $735 billion is in foreign direct investment and a further $460 billion in portfolio equity investments. Of the various forms of foreign direct investment, I'll refer to it as FDI, has been the most stable funding source other than other key forms of external finance, such as foreign portfolio investment and debt. According to the ABS, the primary source countries for the stock of FDI are the United States, with more than $173 billion, around a quarter, followed by Japan at $86 billion, the UK at $76 billion, and with China, Singapore and Canada at less than 5% each. Now, that's by value. Other things being equal, good FDI is our preferred means of financing our current account deficit. It not only covers the gap, but does so in a way that brings multiplier benefits to our economy. Now, this includes increased competition. The entry into the Australian market of German grocery chain Aldi and US grocery chain Costco has had a substantial positive impact for consumers and shaken up what was a tightly controlled supermarket duopoly. Aldi and Costco will account for around 20% of the supermarket sector over the next decade. The decision to allow foreign banks into Australia had similar impacts on our rather sclerotic banking system back in the 1980s, expanding credit growth for businesses that in turn fuelled their growth. FDI has helped create world-class services offerings clustering around advanced manufacturing, and even in our export mainstays of resources and energy. For instance, Boeing has made a significant contribution to the Australian economy over the last decade and invested more than $800 million in Victoria. Around 1,200 people work at its facility in Port Melbourne, which now houses Boeing's largest R&D site outside the United States. CSIRO and nine Australian universities are collaborating directly with Boeing at their research and technology hub in Australia. FDI also drives productivity improvements through improved access to markets, technology transfer, and hardwired linkages into expanding global supply chains. In 2016, GlaxoSmithKline opened a pilot vaccine facility in Victoria, which uses groundbreaking technology for the delivery of vaccines, and they invested more than $100 million over the past 4 years. In 2014, British Defence and aerospace company BAE Systems opened a $10 million components production facility in South Australia, where it will produce titanium tail fins for the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. And Saab established a new advanced maritime systems centre in the Adelaide Technology Park, employing over 100 local combat systems engineers, project managers and software engineers. FDI is also supporting jobs and communities in agriculture, where the sector is desperately in need of capital. The bottom line is that in many cases, foreign investors are coming in and supporting agricultural enterprises that have not received the same support from Australian investors. British dairy company Longleaf Farm invested more than $100 million in a high-tech milk processing facility in Casino, New South Wales, developing a unique export business based on a patented fast-freeze technology. Chinese investors have also been active in agricultural investment. However, the level of involvement suggested in some public commentary is exaggerated. The Agricultural Land Register firstly shows that 86.4% of all agricultural land in Australia is owned by Australians, and that of the 13.6% of agricultural land owned by foreign interests, over 80% of this interest is leasehold. Less than one half of 1% of all agricultural land in Australia is owned by Chinese nationals. And like with foreign investment more broadly, Chinese nationals are not the dominant foreign ownership source. China accounts for just 3% of all foreign-owned agricultural land, while the Americans, British and Dutch account for more than two-thirds of those holdings. Of the major agricultural foreign investment applications I, as Treasurer, have approved, the largest were to combinations of US, Canadian, Dutch and Swiss investors, not Chinese. And those that have been approved have received support, all of them, including the Chinese proposals, because like foreign investment from all other sources, they are adding value, creating jobs and improving productivity. This year, Kimberley Agricultural Investment, KII, a Chinese subsidiary, purchased Carlton Hill Station in the Ord River District of Western Australia. KIA has invested up to $700 million over 6 years on greenfield agricultural development near Kununurra. While acknowledging the value and contribution of foreign investment to our national prosperity, it is important to strike a balance between maintaining an attractive and welcoming environment for foreign capital on the one hand and maintaining community confidence in the foreign investment regime that we administer. As I found with immigration and that my capacity in that portfolio, Australians must have confidence that there are clear rules that protect the national interests and that these rules are being enforced. That is why our government has acted to strengthen the controls we place on foreign investment, and we are following through with improved enforcement to pursue those who break the rules. For residential real estate, we have established a dedicated unit within the ATO to review cases and strengthen compliance. This has already improved compliance and enforcement through the use of the ATO's sophisticated data matching systems and specialised staff with compliance expertise. 96 million of divestments have so far been ordered under this new compliance regime by our government. Foreign investors are also not allowed to profit from breaking the law. Stricter and more flexible penalties have been introduced to make it easier to pursue foreign investors that breach the rules. We have also increased application fees for foreign investors purchasing real estate to ensure that Australian taxpayers no longer have to fund the cost of administering this system. For agriculture, we increased scrutiny and transparency around agriculture investments, including by lowering the screening threshold from $252 million to $15 million applied cumulatively on 1 March 2015 and enshrining that in legislation. We have also applied a $55 million threshold to investments in agribusiness. We also introduced increased and unprecedented transparency into the system through the creation of a comprehensive register of foreign ownership of agricultural land that I referred to before that commenced collecting data on the 1st of July of last year. Infrastructure asset sales is a new and growing challenge for our foreign investment regime, requiring a greater capacity to focus on national security issues. In response, I boosted FIRB's expertise in this area with the appointments of David Irvine and David Peaver to FIRB, who have well-recognised experience in these areas and are adding much value to FIRB's deliberations. We also acted to enable FIRB to formally review critical infrastructure assets sold by state and territory governments to private foreign investors from the 31st of March of this year in accordance with the relevant thresholds. It is also important that we place tight controls on how these assets are managed and controlled when foreign investment is involved. That is why, as Treasurer, I have imposed unprecedented new conditions on foreign investment in infrastructure assets to ensure that control of the assets is kept in the hands of Australian citizens with security clearances as appropriate. This includes insisting that the majority of board members of new ownership entities are Australian citizens, and even requires a majority of Australian citizen board members to satisfy quorum requirements for board meetings, including subcommittees. Another key issue that concerns Australians about foreign investment is whether foreign investors pay tax on their operations in Australia. That is why, on each transaction I approve, I have opposed a new tax deed which, if a company, for example, seeks to shift profits offshore to avoid paying tax in Australia, I can force the divestment of the asset in addition to other existing penalties provided for in our multinational anti-avoidance laws we successfully introduced at the end of last year. It is true that the vast majority of foreign investment proposals that go to the FIRB and ultimately the decision maker, myself as Treasurer or others, are accepted. But that is not without proper scrutiny first, by either myself on major transactions or the Minister for Small Business or Treasury on lesser value transactions making the final decision. I'm on the record as throwing my support behind proposals that have demonstrated that they are not contrary to the national interest and can make a positive contribution to our community and our economy. However, at the same time, I've demonstrated that I will not approve foreign investment proposals if I come to a considered view that they are contrary to the national interest. These instances demonstrate that the system is working. If I said yes to everything, the Australian community would be rightly concerned that we weren't taking this issue seriously. That said, we want to ensure the process is as efficient as it can be. For the first time, we've just done a survey of FIRB users to invite feedback on their experience with our systems. And I've asked Treasury to work with the FIRB board to see if we can put something in place to ensure that we have a mechanism for users to provide feedback on a regular basis should they choose to do so. Now, like foreign investment, trade has also been a staple of Australia's economic growth and critical to addressing our current account deficit and boosting Australia's living standards. Our export trade deals were a core component of our national plan for jobs and growth that we took successfully to the election. In 2015, Australia's global trade export trade volume, including our tourism and international education sectors, delivered around $363 billion to our economy and accounted for around 19% of our GDP in value terms. In the June quarter, our exports rose some 1.3% to be 9.6% higher over the past year. This was the highest through-the-year growth in exports since the Sydney Olympics. A key feature of our export growth is that it is increasingly broad-based, supporting the successful transition we are making from the mining investment boom to broader base growth. Mining exports rose by 15% over the past year as the industry continues to shift from the investment phase to the production phase. At the same time, service exports were up 6.3% through the year, with tourism and education continuing to be strong performers. Central to the growth in services exports has been the growth in earnings within our tourism and international education sectors. With more than 7 million visitors a year, including more than 100,000 every month from China, adding more than $40 billion, or 3% a year to GDP, and supporting 580,000 jobs, the gains are obvious from that sector. Similarly, in education, where international students generate some $19 billion for our economy, with around 650,000 students enrolling last year. In addition to healthcare, the next waves of service exports will be in human services, such as aged and disability care, where Australia has a strong reputation. Our recent trade agreements open up real opportunities for these services overseas. These results have been achieved against a backdrop, of declining growth in the volume of world trade, which is concerning. Growth in world merchandise trade has stayed below 3% on an annual basis for 5 years, and in 2015 its value fell because of shifting exchange rates and falls in commodity prices. In a world where many economies are contemplating pulling the drawbridge up on trade, it is in Australia's national interest to stay the course and argue the case for continued trade liberalisation to keep markets open. We cannot afford not to trade as an economy. On this score, the Coalition Government has practised what it is preaching, first under Tony Abbott and now under Malcolm Turnbull. The FTAs, secured under a coalition government with the powerhouse economies of North Asia, China, Japan and South Korea, are delivering significant opportunities to expand Australian sales abroad and boost employment here at home. Not only do they cut tariffs on Australian exports, but they also provide for more open treatment and greater regulatory certainty for our service providers and investors. That same process is now being rolled out with our ASEAN trade partners. This makes sure Australian companies have every opportunity to compete on a level playing field and make the best of their hard work, skilled people and innovative ideas in the international marketplace. Practically speaking, it has been really pleasing to see some of the early results from the most recent of these deals with China. For example, in the first 6 months of this year, there's been a doubling in the value of Chinese imports of fresh mangoes, fresh cherries, fresh table grapes, and fresh oranges from Australia, all on products where tariffs have been cut twice already and are on their way to zero in coming years. Fresh and chilled boneless beef imports into China have also grown by around 20% in the first half of this year, which is great news for that important export industry as those tariffs also come down. There's also good news on fresh lobster, abalone and manufactured products like unalloyed zinc, with producers taking advantage of the removal and reduction of tariffs on these products. These excellent China results build on earlier success from the FTAs with Korea and Japan, where, for example, in Penrith, we have sake producers selling sake to Japan. Producing that benefit in 2015 from FTA-driven tariff cuts in these markets included fresh and chilled beef, macadamias, cherries, almonds, chipping potatoes, table grapes, rolled oats, fish asparagus and wine. I feel like I'm a spokesperson for one of the grocery shops that are in one of Frank's centres. Finally, our success as an immigrant nation, and I believe we are the most successful immigrant country on earth, has been central to building the successful and prosperous economy we have today. Not as only has the volume of our immigration program been the prime driver of population growth that has supported our economic growth, but it has been the composition of our immigration intake that has been equally important. Our immigration program sets itself apart from other countries as it is built on attracting people and families in a non-discriminatory way to Australia who want and are unable to, as I said earlier, make a contribution rather than take one. Our immigration policies have always had, when they have been most successful, a strong economic focus. While we have a higher proportion of foreign-born citizens, we have a lower unemployment rate than many other OECD countries in those communities. We do it better than anyone. An immigration system geared towards attracting migrants with high rates of workforce engagement and employment in skilled areas increases the productive capacity of our economy, thereby benefiting all Australians. The accompanying boost in economic activity generated, according to the Productivity Commission, can increase GDP per person by around 7%. The Productivity Commission is projecting our GDP to be around 60% higher by 2060 than it would with only natural increases in population. This is almost $1 trillion in today's terms. We saw this economic impact during the years of the Howard government, when not only did we double the level of permanent immigration intake to Australia, but we increased the proportion of skilled migration of our intake from less than 30% under Labor in 1996 to almost 70%, where it has largely remained ever since. The Turnbull government is committed to ensuring that we keep this strong economic focus within our immigration program. The factors that produce these economic results also result in greater social cohesion. In their 2011 policy paper titled Selection, Migration and Integration, Why Multiculturalism Works in Australia and Fails in Europe, the Centre for Independent Studies studied the effects of policies regulating immigration in Australia and New Zealand. It found that the relatively high educational and occupational status of immigrants' parents fully explains, on their analysis, the better educational performance of immigrant children. The CIS observed that Australia's predominantly receive migrants who are qualified and capable of easily integrating into society, and that Australia has been cherry-picking the best qualified migrants most likely to make a positive contribution. The CIS went further to say that if Australia wants to continue the process of attracting migrants into the future, it should not deviate from its policy of selecting migrants by their suitability. And they're right. Coalition governments have always seen the merits of this approach, from Menzies to Turnbull, seeking the reinforcing outcomes of economic contribution and social cohesion provides the foundation of community confidence in our immigration program, which is necessary for its ongoing public support. Upholding this confidence is one of the key reasons why I personally, our government and the Howard government before us took such a strong stance on border protection. While at the same time our immigration was doubled by the Howard government, public concern about immigration levels being too high, as measured by the Scanlon Foundation survey, was halved. Double the rate of intake, halved the rate of concerns. More recent Scanlon Foundation surveys have found that the proportion of Australians who believe the number of immigrants accepted is too high has again fallen since 2013, when our borders had been in turmoil after years of failed border protection policies under the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd governments. The Lowy Institute's own 2016 poll found that 73% of Australians now agree, like me, that immigration has a positive impact on our economy, and 72% agree that accepting migrants from many different countries makes us stronger and strengthens us because of immigrants' hard work and talents. This is in contrast to international surveys which Scanlon notes found disapproval of government handling of immigration in 12 European countries, and which averaged 60% in 2014. Including, it would be foolish for anyone to deny that there is concern about immigration in Australia. The way to address it, though, is not to be dismissive of those concerns, but to engage on those concerns and have policies that effectively address them. As the Coalition has done, under Howard, under Abbott, under Turnbull, and ably assisted, I would like to think, by their respective immigration ministers. The same is true for our approach to foreign investment and trade, where our policies are delivering real economic benefits for Australians across the country. So we will continue to pursue immigration, trade, and foreign investment policies that are focused on the national interest. By focusing on how Australians can participate and benefit from a growing economy to boost wages, to increase profits, and to raise all of our living standards. Now, this has been our history. It has played a major role in delivering the prosperity that we enjoy today, and it must also be our future. We cannot deny this same prosperity to future generations by disconnecting ourselves from the very sources of this prosperity, namely foreign investment, trade, and immigration into the future. Our economy is successfully transitioning, remarkably so. We're one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing, advanced economy in the world today. Over 2015-16, we grew by 3.3% and generated around 220,000 jobs. We have just completed 25 years of consecutive growth and are going after the Dutch record in about a year and a quarter's time. The Turnbull government's national economic plan for jobs and growth that we are delivering is all about setting up the next 25 years. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Treasurer. The Treasurer has agreed to take questions. We have about 15 or 20 minutes. I'm going to ask you to direct your questions to the substance of his important speech today. While you're gathering your thoughts, let me ask one or two to the Treasurer myself. And let me go straight to this question of how the Australian public is reacting to how the Australian public is comporting itself on some of these questions. We are seeing around the world the rise of nativism and populism and isolationism, incredible results like Brexit and the rise of extremist candidates on both sides of politics, including Mr. Trump. Now, in Australia, you noted some opinion polls, the opinion poll result on Muslim immigration, but also even in the Lowy Institute poll this year, we found that 87% of Australians oppose foreign investment in Australian farmland. Yeah. So how much is Australia at risk of these issues of populism and isolationism sloshing into our system? We haven't felt the effects so much yet at the formal political level, but is the kind of argument you're making today becoming harder to prosecute?
Well, Australians, I think, ultimately are practical people, and they focus on results. And I think as we seek to manage these issues, we've got to focus on what is true rather than what feels true in dealing with the facts around these issues. And what I'm doing today is attempting to address that issue. At the end of the day, Australians simply want to be able to address the pressures they face. They can see that around the world, things are volatile, they're uncertain. Whether it's from even in the great democracy of the United States as they go through an election to elsewhere in the world. They get it that the economy is volatile. They get it that it's uncertain. And what they are looking at is their own situation here in Australia. And conscious of the fact that, real wage growth is half what it was 10 years ago. And they are aware that as an economy, I think broadly, we're doing a lot better than other places of the world. There's nowhere else you'd rather be than here in Australia. But, you know, it's always about what happens next, not what's happened for the last 25 years. And they're looking forward and saying, well, where is that earnings going to come from? Where am I going to be able to get ahead in the future? There is a lot of change. They understand that. And it's important that as a government we continue to provide concrete ways forward that deliver against that ultimate insecurity that people will naturally feel. Now, others will offer different explanations. The Doona economics approach. We've got to be careful, incredibly careful, and resist the political temptation of going down that path. And in doing so, it's important not to dismiss the genuine anxiety that exists around those issues. And whether it's in my portfolio in immigration or in social services or now in Treasury, I've noticed similar sentiments. And I've always found it best to try and understand what is driving that sentiment rather than commentate on what people are commentating about how others are thinking of responding to it.
Let me come at the issue from the other side, from the international economic point of view. How would you categorise the state of the international economy at the moment? What are the biggest risks in the international economy? And in particular, what is the risk of further uncertainty flowing from a Trump victory in November?
Well, the biggest risk globally, is a retreat from a global economy, and particularly large advanced economies withdrawing from a global economy and succumbing, I think, to some of these other broader influences that are out there. And I think it's important. I mean, I showed you the figures on what's happening with world trade. And at the most recent G20 meeting, again, both with the one the Prime Minister attended in Hangzhou and where I attended in Chengdu, we are constantly noting these rather weak world trade figures. And, you know, in that context, Australia has a vested interest in standing up to argue the case for all of the things I've talked about today. And we can do it on the basis of a very good record, that has delivered prosperity. I mean, when people come and ask us, well, how has this happened, 25 years of consecutive growth? Well, yeah, we had a few things go our way, but we had a lot of things that worked against us too. But when you look at the impact of immigration, foreign investment and trade in driving what we've been able to achieve, I mean, the results are there to see. So, you know, I think we've got both candidates in the United States talking about drawing back, both of them. And equally, we've seen similar sentiments in other places. So that's one issue. I think the other issue is global financial stability. And again, what happened post-GFC, I think, has been very encouraging. Post-Brexit, what we saw was actually the world's financial systems work as opposed to not working. And whether it was Sean Carney over there in the Bank of London or other places, we saw the world financial system prepare stress tests and then move through what was a period of challenge. And with Basel IV on its way, I think the improvements in global prudential regulation have been positive. And, equally, there are populist sentiments about royal commissions on banks too. Well, can I tell you? The reason we survived the global financial crisis was because of the strength of our banking system and the regulations that sat behind that. Now, banks today are stronger in those terms than they have ever been. But that can't be taken for granted. And one of the great concerns I have about what others proposing a Royal Commission was doing is it would just bring to a halt so much of the positive work that is being done in both the regulatory side of our financial system and what is being done within the financial system itself by the banks and other agencies to actually increase the resilience of the Australian economy through their efforts. So I think that is another area of populism that we need to be very careful to avoid.
Who would like to ask a question? I saw this gentleman first. I'll ask you to... Actually, Ali, this gentleman first. I'll ask you to just identify yourself briefly and then ask a brief question to the Treasurer, please.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
One of the drivers of the anxiety you've both mentioned is undoubtedly the growing inequality of economic outcomes. A rising tide is not lifting all boats very clearly. The World Bank and the IMF have written reports highlighting the risks of inequality. In Australia, as in other economies around the world, the share of GDP to capital is at record highs, the share of GDP to labour at record lows. How will your policy suite address that? Not the economic growth per se, but the economic equality of that growth.
One of the things I've been focusing on in particular is how we're going to boost the real wages of Australians. I think that is one of the biggest economic challenges that we have. And the best way to do that is improve the performance of Australian businesses that employ them. And to have a culture of growth in Australian business that ensures that all employees gain from that success. And this is why I've been so passionate about the support for small and medium-sized enterprises. I mean, small and medium-sized businesses, you know, they pay their employees first, their creditors second, and they pay themselves third. And that's how they grow their business. And I'm keen to do what we can as a government to ensure that we're supporting businesses that reinvesting in their businesses. And I'm talking about businesses that between 2 and 10 million have an average, a number of employees of around 22. There are many of them in my electorate and electorates all around the country. I've visited a large number of them. And those employees know that when the company is doing better, they're going to do better too. And they're going to have greater job security and greater certainty about their incomes. And when you have that, then you can spend, you can invest, you can make decisions. Otherwise, you will retreat. Now, household consumption has been the most significant contributor to Australia's economic growth over the last 25 years. Daylight second. But household consumption in our economy, which has proved relatively resilient, has been there because of people being able to be in work and have some sort of certainty about their income. So the income challenge, in my last address I talked about our earnings problem. Addressing the earnings problem is about lifting the real wages of Australians. But for that to happen, the economy has to earn more, and it needs to earn more.
I saw this gentleman next.
Good afternoon, Treasurer. My name is Roger Woodward. I was an independent candidate in the 2016 election. My understanding is that the two biggest components of federal expenditure are health and social services. What are the three largest components of the social services budget? Thanks.
Well, the largest is the age pension. That's the biggest component. And then after that, I mean, when I was in social services, it also included aged care and childcare, and both of those are the fastest growing components of that expenditure for obvious reasons. But the age pension is it's daylight second after that. A lot of the areas, I mean, family tax benefit payments, they're up around 20% of the spending, and that is another huge component of what goes out in transfer payments in the welfare sector. And then after that, it falls down to issues like the dole payments, the New Start payments, and youth allowance, others, and there's a series of sundry payments around those things. I mean, we have some 20 different payments in the welfare sector and 53 different supplements. I mean, Patrick McClure did an excellent report for me when I was Minister for Social Services, which highlighted the unsustainability of the complexity of that sort of a system. And every Australian, I think, accepts and supports the notion of a strong social safety net. We all do. But we want it to be sustainable for the people who most need it. And for that to happen, I think you need to ensure these payments are always very fit for purpose. They're always very well targeted. I mean, currently we have a proposal in front of the Parliament which would remove the family tax benefit supplement payments and reinvest all of that back into a reformed childcare system. Now, that is taking one set of payments which have become redundant because they were introduced as a balancing payment for the income estimation measure for how people got their fortnightly family tax benefit payments. And so it was there at the end to balance it off if people had been overpaid. Now, with the one-touch payroll system, that will be made redundant. And so we thought it was an excellent idea to take one set of payments, which no longer were fit for purpose, for families, and channel that into more affordable childcare. Now, those changes still remain opposed by the majority of those in the Parliament. Now, in the new Senate, there is a lot more support for that than in the past Senate, and I hope that will result in a better outcome. Our social welfare system, as I've said, I used to say when I was a minister, 8 out of 10 income taxpayers are required to go to work every day to pay for it, and its growth is very strong, and we're just going to make sure that we're spending that money as best as we can in the way it helps the people who need it the most, and ensure that where it isn't doing its job, then those revenues can be restored to the budget to ensure that the whole system is sustainable.
Treasurer, let me ask you a question on the other end of the spectrum about the G20. You mentioned that you attended the G20. How valuable did you find it as a forum, as an opportunity to meet your counterparts from other major economies? How important is it that Australia is a member of organisations like the G20, and what are the prospects for the G20, do you think?
Well, first of all, it was a nice reminder that I was very happy I was an Australian, and that we're in the economy we were in. And I think that, I mean, there's not one seat I'd rather trade than the one we sit in at the G20, where we've been able to place ourselves and what our prospects are going forward. The second interesting thing I find about the G20 debates is the amount of attention that is focused on fiscal stimulus policy and monetary policy. And I think both of these have exhausted themselves over the last 5 or 6, 7 years. And for some questionable benefit. Monetary policy at best is really just going to bring investment forward. It doesn't necessarily create anything, and I'd argue you could say similar things about other forms of fiscal stimulus. What we collectively have to do as a G20 set of countries is focus on private investment and the private investment that is going into our economies. I mean, the fact that it is seen as a sound investment proposition to take $10 million, give it to the German government for 10 years and get it back what you gave them and pay them for the privilege, i.e. negative interest rates, and that is where productive capital might go, says a lot about the need for capital to find growth-friendly investments around the world. Now, I think the opportunity I see when I look at what the G20 countries are doing is for Australia to set itself apart as a place which is engaging in economic reforms, which is going to attract the investment capital that I've been talking about today, because there's something going on here that they can see, like under the Hilmer reforms of many years ago or the other changes that were made in Australia over 25 years and more, under both sides of politics, that investors will see, I want a part of the growth that's happening in that economy, because they are engaging in things that are going to grow the economy. Now, for the G20 more broadly, I think it remains an excellent forum to have those sorts of discussions and to really argue the case of why trade remains important and why foreign investment remains important. And on a bilateral level, I find the meetings enormously useful. It's a bit like a speed dating exercise when you're there for everybody, but the ability to talk to so many very senior people in such a short period of time, and if you like, bounce the conversations that you're having with each other off each other, I find to be enormously useful.
We've got time for a couple more questions. Yes, this lady here in the second row.
It's Michelle Brown from ABC News. Treasurer, you mentioned that part of the popular dissatisfaction arises from stagnant wages growth. Ian Ross from the Fair Work Commission has proposed a way of increasing the base wage by allowing employees to trade away penalties and overtime. Is that an idea that sounds good to you?
Well, as you know, all of those sorts of issues are sorted out through the relevant commissions. What works is increased productivity. That's what works. What works is increased investment. What works is increased profits. What works is employees and employees actually working together to get better outcomes for both of them. That's what works. That's what's worked in the past. And I'm not a treasurer that really would seek to meddle in these things. I think the companies that have got themselves from, starting up with nothing and got them up to 2 million and then to 5 million or then 10 and 25, and they all aspire to reach Frank and Stephen's heights, as they should. It's one of the most remarkable success stories in Australia's history is Westfield and many companies like it. But the way they get there is they come up with good products, they work well with their employees and they make a profit and they pay their people well. Sounds like a plan.
Final question, the lady over there. Yes.
Thank you for a fascinating talk. My name is Georgia Stianovich, member of the public. You mentioned that cherry-picking immigrants based on their educational levels has worked very well for us in the past and is the basis for the successful multicultural society. We are faced with a range of black swan events, and immigration from Syria and the Middle East is one of them. So are we not perhaps making a mistake by using the thinking that has served us in the past, inductive thinking based on the past successes, It's a bit like the turkey expecting to be fed every day until Christmas. So, I mean, black swan events cannot be resolved with inductive reasoning, so perhaps we may need a different strategy.
Well, the strategy we've always applied under when we've run it successfully on the refugee and humanitarian program is we have had a screening process and we have had a deliberate process of where we've taken people from. And you know, one of the most important things that you focus on if you're an immigration minister crafting the componentry of the refugee and humanitarian program is you focus on how are your settlement services, which, by the way, we have the best settlement services of any country in the world. That's not any member of any government's claim. That's actually the conclusion of the UN. We have the best settlement services in the world. And what we do in this country better than anyone else is we support people when they come. So there are plenty of countries that will allow people to rush across their borders and allow them to pitch a tent, but they won't get them into school. They won't give them English lessons. They won't give them employment support. They won't run a hub like you'll find up in Logan where you can all come together on one day and all the services will be standing there and you'll have a case officer for a year and they'll give you a month's accommodation to get started. You won't get that in all these other countries. We are successful in how we've run our formal refugee and humanitarian program because we've always invested simultaneously in the settlement support services that go along with it. And, you know, those services don't have an infinite capability. And the minute we start, I think, compromising the level of actual support that we give to people when they come, then we start to compromise the ability of those that we've asked to come to be able to succeed in our country. And it's incredibly important that they do succeed. And so many of them have. And the reason they have is we've backed in the invitation with genuine support to help them settle in Australia. So our immigration intake for the refugee and humanitarian program is rising to 18,750, where it will remain. And on top of that, there was the 12,000 commitment for those to be resettled out of the surrounding countries in Syria, particularly out of Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey. Now, where we're taking them into Australia, we are resettling people who will never, ever be able to go back to that part of the world. Never, ever. And those are the oppressed minorities in that part of the world, which are majority Christian, but there are others who are also oppressed. I mean, they will never, ever be able to go back there. And that's why we're offering them permanent resettlement in Australia with a permanent resettlement program that helps them do everything they can to be success here in Australia. And so we have a generous program. And it's generous not just in terms of its actual numbers, but more importantly, it's generous in the support it rightly provides to help people who come under that program be a success.
Treasurer, as you know, there's no orthodoxy at the Institute. We say we are host to the widest variety of views, but advocate of none. And so on the US alliance or defence or China or any of these issues, there are different views within the Institute. But I think one thing that we all hold in common is a belief that Australia is strongest when it's open to the world, when it's internationally engaged, when we're ambitious and we're confident about our future in the world. So I'd like to thank you for making a strong argument for openness on behalf of Australia. And thank you for such a rich speech and for taking our questions. I also wish you well on Sunday. I know you'll be cheering from the stands, and I hope that this year Harold Holt is in the stands with you.
Absolutely.
Cheering. Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the Treasurer.